Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. It's another week here with Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson. What's up, Ryan?
I'm doing good. I'm feeling relaxed. I just got back from Mexico and just went on a kind of a business retreat with a bunch of other business owners that I got to spend some great time with and swap stories and just iron sharpens iron kind of thing. And glad to be back and glad to be recharged mentally to get back into the show. Great.
Yeah, I just got back from the Pilot Network Conference, TPNX, up in Minneapolis. It was snowing in late April in Minneapolis. Nice. So it's nice to be back in Honolulu for a few days here. But with that, hey, we've got our best guest ever, dare I say, Toby Mathis on today.
Absolutely. No one more real, too. I mean, Toby is the real deal. He invests in real estate himself. He invests in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, the whole thing. He's not just out there giving advice. I mean, he is literally doing it. That's what I love about him. He's actually experiencing the tax and legal aspects and the asset protection of life, and then also helping people achieve that. And, you know, we mentioned in the show, there is a tax and legal workshop they put on in person. I'm actually going to be the one in Dallas. It's in June 27th to June 29th. So if you're like, hey, I want to meet Toby and see what this is all about, and you want to meet like-minded people, it's a great event. I've been going to it for a couple of times and just meet some great people and go out for nice dinners. And it's a lot of fun and you get to learn a ton about investing and things like that. So we're not like, promoting the show or anything like that, but you know, just it's just a great way to get out there and network, which Tate and I love to do.
Absolutely. Well, with that, let's get into it. We're going to talk about the top five ways that pilots can cut their tax bill. So without further ado, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Toby, thank you so much for joining us. You are the number one guest that's ever been on our show. You get the most number of downloads. You're the most talked about guest. So thank you for coming onto the show for a third time to talk about how we can kill our tax bills.
Thanks for having me. I just like kill that tax
That's right.
bill. I like the way
you're the man. So yeah, we appreciate you coming back on.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me. And it's not about making your taxes go away. It's just keeping them to a reasonable amount and paying the least amount you're legally required to. I don't want to be one of those guys that says you don't have to pay the IRS. You do. It's just you just don't have to leave them a tip.
And zero can be reasonable, right? Like zero taxes is reasonable.
Zero can be reasonable under your circumstances. It's hard. I would say you don't really want to be around zero. You really want to be between 100 and 200. Your audit rate's really low. You're paying a small percentage of your overall income. It's not horrible. And anything below 20%, I'm not going to cry about. The part that gets really painful is when you're making a dollar and half of it's going to your state and federal taxes.
Yeah.
Then it makes you really, it's tough to want to go out there and generate more income when you're splitting it with your silent partners, right?
Can you reiterate that for anybody that doesn't have their head fully wrapped around the tax brackets? We're going to get real, real basic elementary level here. If you're in the 37% tax bracket, that doesn't mean that every dollar is taxed 37%, right? So that's why we don't want to slam your income all the way down to zero, because the first 100, 200, 300,000, if you're married, isn't wildly highly taxed, right?
Right. We're under the more you make, the more they take rule. It's a progressive tax system. So your first dollars might be zero. Then you have dollar because you have a standard deduction right now, close to 14 grand, right? And then you get above that, you're at 10%, 12%, 22%, 24%. And then the more you make, the higher the dollars above that amount are taxed. So it's never retroactive. Like you never go back to the first $10,000 you made that's not going to be taxed at all and say, now we're going to tax it at 37%. What they're going to do is say, any amount that you make over 500,000, whatever it is now taxed at 37%. So and then it starts getting more and more painful. And I always call that tax pain. It's an easy way. It's like, how bad is it? If you're making $150,000 and you have a few, make an extra 10 grand, the tax pain's not vicious, right? It's still annoying, but you're up over $500,000 and you make an extra 10 grand, depending on what state you're living in, that could be really annoying when you're given quite literally half of it away.
Right.
And you're like, gosh, this stinks. Why would I even do this?
Right. Which makes the strategies that we're going to talk about on the show ever more powerful, the more money you make, right? So airline pilots are all, everybody's signing these new contracts with these really nice pay rates. The problem there is that it's all W-2, right? And so if you make an extra 100,000, you're already making $500,000. So that last 100,000 it's diminishing returns, right? And the more you make, it's adding less to your bottom line.
Toby, I want to talk about aircraft ownership. Pilots love to buy airplanes and fly them, and they love to save on taxes. So here we go. Let's get into how you can own an airplane and how it can benefit you on your tax bill a little bit.
It's the same thing you get into with cars, right? People buy a car and they're like, I'm going to buy a really nice car because my accountant said I could write it off if it's over 6,000 gross vehicle weight. And they're kind of right, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have over so much business usage, generally 50%. So when we look at the personal uses, it's still taxable to you. Like you're getting a partial deduction. It's not like I get to write the whole thing off. Or if I had a nickel for every time somebody said I bought a Land Rover at the end of the year and wrote it all off. And I'm like, how much of it was business use? What? My wife's driving or whatever. You're like, gosh, bless it. You're not going to get a deduction. The same things kind of flow true for aircraft. So when you're buying an aircraft and it's personal use, you get no deduction. It's just personal use, no different than a car or your house, right? You're just not going to get to write off the cost of running it, right? If you switch it over into a trade or a business, then you need to actually engage an aircraft leasing company and put it into a pool to actually make it something where you are intending to make a profit out of the activity. Now we're into something where we can take pretty large deductions in the very beginning of its life. Up until the last couple of years, we had 100% bonus depreciation on an aircraft. So even if you financed aircraft, let's say you financed $1 million aircraft, you got $1 million deduction in year one. It was nice. I had a client last year bought a $8 million aircraft financed, but his deduction was $8 million. And in order to qualify for it, he had to make sure that he was putting it out to be used when he wasn't using it and trying to generate income off of it. You do that, then you get the deduction. If you don't do that, then you don't. It's that simple. So if you're buying an aircraft, you got to somehow make it into a trader business. Generally, you're putting it into an LLC and you're engaging an aviation lease company. There's one in Florida, I believe, that they won a big case in Tennessee, not to get confusing, but they actually did it right. And what it really comes down to is making sure that here's this aircraft that I'm writing off 100%, so it's business use. Now, my use, there needs to be a taxable event to me because I'm using a business asset. So it'd be like if when you're flying for Delta, Ryan, you said, hey, can I borrow a jet for the weekend? They're not just going to say, sure. They're going to say, if you're, you know, here, we might lease it to you, right? They're not going to do it. But let's just pretend. We might let you use it for a fee. The same is true when you're leasing your own aircraft. And the reason you're doing that is because you're going to fly it very few days compared to the days that it's actually there. And so you want to write off all of the maintenance, all of the upkeep, and having to rent a place to store it and all that jazz, unless you're somehow putting it in your backyard, right? So there's lots of costs, plus there's the aircraft, plus there's interest. You want to write all that off. Then the easiest way to do it is to treat it as a business. And then when you use it, you're actually those days. And I know you're thinking, I'm going to be flying it all the time. I don't know how many days somebody actually uses it, but my guess is it's
not very much.
Yeah, it's going to be, you think, a tenth of the time, less. So now you're writing everything off and you can actually create loss on your return. I know there's a lot of folks that will lose their minds going, there's the hobby loss rule. Yeah, it's a rule. It's 3 out of 5 years. You got to show you're going to make a profit. So, but that's not the only thing. If you're actually running it like a trader business and you're keeping books and you're doing it right, you can actually incur losses. The longest case I've seen was 38 years in a row. That's not a death knell. It's just a hurdle you have to get over. So if you lose money every year with your aircraft, there might be an audit. So you want to make sure that you have your T's crossed and your I's dotted.
Well, what we know that ever since somebody flipped a coin to fly, who went to go fly first, the airlines have been, no one's ever made any money in aviation when you sum it all up. So anyway, so let's get like hypothetical. So if the three of us got together and I basically said, hey, my company is a leasing company and I'm going to lease your airplane for you and we're the customers and we're the investors, does that pass the sniff test for something like that?
You'd have an issue with kind of, I think you'd have an issue unless you were leasing it at fair market value. If you were the only customers. It sounds like he kind of bought something for personal use and just divvied it up. You know, I'm not an expert in this area. I'll just put that caveat on there.
Sure.
I think it's really important that you still put it into a lease pool. And even if you guys were using it, as long as the money was being paid in for that personal use and the intent was to make a profit, and maybe you guys were just hobarting all the days used, I think you could possibly scale that amount.
But it was,
I don't think the facts are
but
good.
But it was available to the general public.
Yeah. It, really what it comes down to is, am I putting that aircraft out to be rented at a fair market rate to make money?
Right.
If the answer is yes, then it's a business. And then we're looking at it saying, what percentage of the time is it? Is that the case? If it's personal use and there's four of you, I'm worried that if it's more than half, that you're going to run into a big issue. I think you run into a buzzsaw.
That's great to know that rule of thumb. Another thing you said is fair market, right? Because I hear sometimes it's like, okay, well, I'll put it out to lease, but I'm going to make it, you know, twice as expensive as it should be so that it just never gets right. So that wouldn't pass the sniff test.
I don't think it would pass the sniff test. You have to make it fair market. Anything below fair market, like in real estate, is considered personal use. So I think they're going to do something similar here.
So just to walk the dog on this, I think you said something that was massively important. You could buy a $1 million airplane. You could put down a 20% down payment, $200,000, and then you could completely write off that $1 million airplane through depreciation. And I know that bonus depreciation is now 60% of what it was, but you effectively could write off 60% of $1 million, so $600,000 in the first year, and that could be at one of the higher tax brackets. Let's just say it's 25%, just to blend it. I mean, that's basically you're writing off the down payment you put down on the plane, which is...
And you're still depreciating the aircraft. If you wrote off $600,000, and by the way, the house, as we're sitting here recording this today, the house is passed a fix to that law to make it 100%, and sitting at the Senate right now. That could be passed, and they were talking about making it retroactive, so...
Yeah.
You know, it could be a lot of fun there.
That's going to be a lot for all the CPAs. They can't wait to redo everyone's taxes.
But you still write off the other $400,000. It's over 7 years generally. Right. So you're still going to be writing off a pretty good chunk of that thing over the next few years anyway.
But what an awesome thing. I mean, you can buy a Cirrus for $1 million, $1.2 million, whatever they are now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the down payment is on aircraft loans, but let's just say it's 20% for all intents and purposes. And then you basically get that money right back in your taxes, and then it's in service.
Can
and making
I give
an
you
income.
An idea? I'm going to throw something out. Yeah. Nobody talks about it. It bugs the crud out of me. We're so used to going out and trying to finance things. There's something, you know, be your own bank, right? I'm not going to schlep insurance, but you could do the IUL. Or if you save consistently, you can do a security back line of credit. So I've purchased a building and I bought out another loan and I did some other stuff with the security back line of credit this year. A typical loan might be 7 or 8%. I think it's 7.5% right now, a typical mortgage. I'm getting my money at 5%. And it's my money. Like, it's literally, I have the stock account. I'm just borrowing against it. I don't have to go through an approval. So I had a client do this last year, same client. It was $8 million. And I think that he did it all. In fact, I know he did it all off of his security back line of credit. He just went to Morgan Stanley and said, hey, give me a loan against it. They'll do that in a heartbeat. And I remember, Ryan, we were in Hawaii once, and I don't know if you remember the event, but the loan rates were less than 2%.
Yeah.
And they go up and down depending on what it could be a variable amount. So if you think that rates are going to go lower, you could borrow and your rate goes lower. You don't have to do anything. Try doing that when you try to, like, you'd have to refi another loan. But I'm just always shocked that people don't do that. Or they'll say, like, I need an aircraft loan while they're sitting on 100% equity in their house.
Right.
I'm like,
right.
That's a good point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Especially, you talked about a couple things there that I want to unpack for anybody that's not familiar. He said IUL, so that's Index Universal Life. There's also Whole Life. We've done episodes on this about doing high cash balance life insurance policies that you can borrow against. And then I love the idea of borrowing against stock accounts. I'm working with a financial advisor, the only financial advisor that I've ever connected with that I see eye to eye with. And I love what he said was, hey, the only reason to have a big stock market account outside of your 401k is to borrow against it and buy more real estate. And I'm like, finally, I found somebody who
actually said the quiet
yeah.
part.
Yeah. So I love that. And then the equity in your house. So many people, I fly with so many people that say, oh, I'm almost done finishing paying off my house. And I'm like, what? I'm like, what's your mortgage rate? 4%. I'm like, why are you throwing money at a 4% loan? Which, you know, hey, whatever you want to do, if it makes you feel comfortable and it's Dave Ramsey, that's fine. But if you're sitting, like you said,
we recorded an entire episode on this.
If you're
sitting on
100% equity in your home and you can put a fresh mortgage on it at a very conservative loan to value ratio, 40%, 30%, 50%, whatever, and it's at 7 and your aircraft loan was going to be at 12. Well,
yep,
there you go.
It's fun. I'll give you an easy one. If you have equity in your house, you can go to something called Figure. I think it's $400,000 limit, but it's a AI loan tool. I did it. I got money in 48 hours. I just wanted to, I don't like mortgages. So I'm one of those guys that's Dave Ramsey probably would be like, yeah, but I understand leverage. And if I could get my money out of my home and I could pay off my home, that I wouldn't care. I'm using it as leverage. There's a difference between debt and leverage. Right. Debt is on a depreciating asset. At leverage is using it on an appreciating asset.
That's such a good point.
Long and short of it is, if I could go quickly, and again, it's figure.com, I think is what it is. You could figure out pretty darn quickly, it's funny. you could figure out pretty quickly how much money you could get out of your house. And again, they did it all AI. It was super less painful because I won't do a mortgage just because I hate doing the paperwork. It was 3%. The guy starts asking me for every document and I'm like, screw this. not going to jump through your hoops. I'm not a poodle. Figure was literally, I think I had the money in 48 hours and it's just AI. They look at your bank account to see if your income can be verified by your deposits.
Interesting.
And they can, AI figures it out and says yes. And you get your money pretty quick. That's an easy one. And no, I'm not a representative of that company, but I just thought it was really funny. It was like how quickly I could do it. I was like, wow, I don't have to talk to people.
That's awesome.
Great. Not everybody wants to go through that process.
So keeping on the train of this, buying an airplane and being able to write it off, I've talked to a lot of pilots who they're bringing up the next generation and they're making a lot of money and they figure, why am I going to go pay a flight school $150 bucks an hour for my son or daughter to go bore holes in the sky? Well, I just buy an airplane. So let's put ourselves in that person's shoes and figure out, okay, how does that end up being an active activity that can be right off to my W-2?
Oh, I'll tell you the steps of what I would do. I would, A, number one, set up an LLC to own the aircraft. B, I would purchase the aircraft. C, I would have a aviation company that specializes in leasing of planes, manage my aircraft and put it on the public market to be leased. And then when I used the aircraft to train my son or daughter, I would pay the fair market value for those days and pay the company just like I was a regular customer.
There we go.
And the idea is I'm going to use it very few days. The benefit of it, it should hopefully pay for itself, if not put a little money in my pocket.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think the answer there would be lease it back to a flight school. So put it in the fleet. There we go.
Not everybody wants to do it. Like, and here's the thing, as I say, you're just going in with your eyes open. If it's going to be personal use, just don't try to write it off.
Right.
But if you're trying to get a good aircraft and you want to do it, it might be that you do put it into the fleet and you say, hey, you know what? This is going to buy my aircraft and it's going to basically pay for it.
Got it. All right. One quick question, because I know Ryan's dying to jump in there, but very important. We've talked a lot in real estate about the difference between active and passive and material participation. That's a hurdle we have to get over in real estate. If that airplane is sitting in a leaseback pool or in a flight school's fleet, would the IRS say, well, that's not an active business because somebody else is managing it for you?
It depends on the level of participation. If you're working, and it's always up to you as to whether you're going to say, hey, I'm meeting the time requirement to be a material participant. There's 7 tests. One of them is I do everything, which clearly isn't the case. Test number 2 is I do 100 hours and it's more than any other individual. Test number 3 is 500 hours and we don't care what anybody does. And that could be combined spouses too. Mm-hmm. So whether or not you're a material participant really matters as to whether the money that's flowing through is going to be treated as self-employment income or whether I have losses, whether those losses are going to offset my ordinary income.
Right. Okay, so how do we get over that hurdle with this example? So you buy a Cessna. Now, Toby, for your information, we're not allowed to work on airplanes unless we've gone to a 2-year program for aircraft and power plant mechanic, right? So it's not like you can get out there and do the engine overhaul in order to qualify that. So how can we spend 100 hours a year on this business in order to make it active?
You would still be managing the actual business itself. Right. So I could be talking to the flight school. I could be looking at and communicating with them on the numbers that are coming out from the leases. I could be approving things. I could still be working with them. And it's something I'm sure that if we dug deep on it, that there might be some better rules. Maybe there'll be something we can do where we do a deep dive on, maybe get an aviation school out here too. Because there are cases on it. Like there are some pretty good cases where people are trying to deduct their plane, and quite often they're self-renting. So they're leasing it to their own business. And when you do that, if the ownership's the same, you can group them. Let's say that you owned a flight school and you bought a hangar, and people are thinking, oh, the hangar is passive. If I leased the hangar to my flight school, that could actually be treated as one economic activity. And the benefit is there's no passive losses at that point. The write-off from that hangar could actually be used against the income that's being derived from the school.
Gotcha.
It could actually create a situation where I have a loss, and I could actually have a nice tax deduction.
Understood.
So that's grouping. And you could do the same thing here.
Understood. That's great. Ryan, I know you're dying to jump in there.
No, I was just going to mention, I just love the fact, I mean, for me, I would probably be the guy that's passive, right? I would want to be like, I'd buy the airplane for my kids, take the deduction, enter it into the flight school, and be completely passive with it. And I guess what you're saying, is it 100 hours per year or per month, or what's the 100 hours?
So the material participation rules for a typical trader business is the general rule, the bright line test is that 500 hours. So if you're spending 500 hours in a business, you're going to be a material participant, you're non-passive. Anything below there, then we have these other little, you have a couple other tests you could run. That generally the workaround, when I see people doing planes, they're self-leasing it. They're using it for their business, and we'll group it with that business. So those losses, now, then we don't care. But if you are a W-2 employee, you're working as an airline pilot and you're trying to offset that, then we might have difficulty if all you do is buy a plane and put it into a rental pool, right? Because that could be very easily construed as a passive activity, your participation, though it's tough when you have sole proprietors, which is generally what you'd be if you set up an LLC and just ignored it. I've never seen a passive sole proprietorship, but you know, in theory, that could be an argument that would be made. I've never seen it. So just throwing it out there that you'd probably want to make sure that you are doing more than just idly standing by, or that if you took a larger deduction, you might be in jeopardy.
All right. Well, I think the takeaway there is work with your tax professional. If you're going to do this, again, don't talk to your tax professional about this 2 weeks before the filing deadline the following year. Be proactive. Create the strategy before you go out and buy that airplane so that you can be forward thinking.
100%. Like in all of this, it's not something I deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I do deal with these things periodically. But you want to make sure that you are crossing those T's and dotting those I's on this, because the benefit is huge. Yeah. So you want to make sure you don't lose it.
Absolutely. Can we quickly apply this to a question that came in, which is from a pilot who recently moved to Montana. They're building a home, and in order to save costs on rentals, they bought an excavator. And the question was, how can I write this thing off? They bought it, I believe, in this calendar year. So it would be subject to 60% bonus depreciation unless it comes back at 100. Would you just take the exact same conversation that we just had and apply it straight to that excavator?
Yeah, it's going to be a tough one, because it sounds like you bought the excavator for the personal use on your property. It's probably not going to be deductible. If you wanted to write it off, then you'd have to use it as a lease. Like there's like what, Turo for cars, right? And you'd have to manage it. You'd do, hey, I'm going to rent it out. And then on the days that I use it, I'm going to pay a fair market value. So if you're going to rent it out to people for $200 a day, you do it. Yes, you could write that thing off so long as more than half of its use is business. Mm-hmm. And then when you have personal use, you just pay those for those days. You're going to find yourself in a situation where it should end up being a tax benefit.
That's awesome. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, I wish it was easier, guys. Like the IRS does make it very difficult. When you're a W-2 employee, you have your Schedule A, which is the mortgage deduction, your medical over 7.5% of your AGI. I think it's 7.5%. Sometimes it's 10. Sometimes I think it's 7.5 this year. You get to take a deduction for charitable donations and you get a state and local tax deduction up to $10,000, right? And then you have to decide whether that amount exceeds your standard deduction. You get to pick one of them. So it's kind of slim pickings. So then you have to go look at your other schedules and you say like, oh, do I have capital losses? Okay, there's restrictions on whether I can write those off. I can use my capital losses against capital gain, or I can write off an extra $3,000 against my ordinary income. And you go to another schedule, like Schedule E, and you're looking at your real estate, and you're like, okay, I can write that off. If I make less than $150,000 a year, I can write off up to $25,000. There's a phase out between $150,000, so it's realistically, unless you're making under $100,000, this isn't going to help you really that much. But hey, maybe I can write off some of my real estate losses, or I need to be a real estate professional, or I need to not be in real estate. I need to be in something where it's business loss, and that gets you into short-term rentals, those types of things. But it really is a small world, or running a business where it operates at a loss for a few years. Okay, yeah. I can do that too. Like that's really what you're kind of limited to. There's not a ton out there. Investment-wise, there is one other that people kind of miss. If I want an ordinary loss on an investment, it's either real estate professional or be an active participant in real estate and be underneath the $100,000 mark. Or I could always invest in oil and gas. And if I am doing a working interest, then that could be an ordinary loss that can offset your income. The problem is oil and gas is it's hit or miss, right? You could have a well that does really well, no pun intended again, or you could have,
all of them
you
today.
Could have, yeah, I'm just, it's happening. But you like, if you, let's just say that I invest in 15 wells, I think like probably 4 or 5 of them need to be producing to break even. If you get above that, you start getting a return, but that return's going to be stretched out over 15 years, right? You might get your money back after 5 or 7. You'll be excited, but you're getting a tax deduction. So like, but the world is pretty small when it comes to things that I can actually do to offset my income. And I know it's frustrating for a lot of folks, especially if they're making a lot of money. They're like, what the heck do I do?
Right.
Okay. There's like 4 or 5 things.
That's why we spend so much time talking about real estate professional status and the short-term rental loophole.
It is the juice worth the squeeze?
Right.
And in both of those, if you are an investor, the answer is yes, because the numbers can be big in real estate and we're used to using leverage. In other businesses, it might be no. Like, for example, if you're buying an airplane and I'm buying a $100,000 airplane, probably not, right? I'm buying $1 million airplane, probably yeah. Mm-hmm. Do I want to go through the rigmarole? A $5 million airplane? Yeah. It's going to be an income producer, right? It's just going to be a while, but you can get a really big tax deduction if you know what you're doing and you follow the rules.
So, Toby, one of the things that we're all about here on the show is bringing on great guests like yourself to talk about these strategies, but then there's a whole element of a podcast where you can really connect the community and meet people face to face and get more involved. You guys put on a tax and legal workshop every quarter, every other month. And
I think we're doing 4 to 5 a
year. Yeah, I think it's like a 4-day like tax and legal boot camp, basically. Can you talk about that? Because I think a lot of pilots have benefited from the ones that I've met that have gone. Can you kind of talk about how that works and what you guys go over and things like that?
Yeah. Yeah, we've been doing the tax and asset protection workshop going on 25 years now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, we've been doing them just for a minute. We do them online. There's a condensed version that we do in one day and almost on a weekly basis. You can just go to Anderson and I'm sure you guys will put a link or something. They can go check that out. But the one you're talking about is we're trying to do them 4 or 5 times a year where we get together and do more of a deep dive over a longer period of time. Sometimes they're 4 days, sometimes they're 3 days. I think we have a 3-day coming up in Texas in June. And yeah, Ryan and your team are always there, which is fun. So if you want to hang out with Ryan, you could do that. But what we're doing is diving into land trusts, LLCs, corporations, tax planning, estate planning, special speakers. Ryan oftentimes comes up and talks, for example. Mm-hmm. We bring in vetted investment opportunities and things like that that work for our type of client, which tends to be the investor, right? I don't have clients that are just, they work, right? They're almost all of them are investors. A lot of them are doing side gigs. Almost everybody's a real estate investor. It's kind of all paths lead there when you're doing tax planning anyway, and it's a great wealth builder. So that's what those are. They're a lot of fun. If you like figuring out how anonymity works, how to make sure somebody can't take the stuff that you're building up. It only takes one little misstep and you're dealing with some pretty frustrating situations. You don't even have to do anything wrong. Literally, you could just own property or have kids and then they do something wrong and you're responsible and you just want to make sure that you're not an easy target.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, as Tate and I met at a conference, and so I looking to kind of go, I think you have them in Dallas, you have them in Orlando, you have them in Vegas, you kind of move them around. So a lot of opportunities to meet like-minded people and make some lifelong connections, really. And I think that's, and learn a lot at the same time. Yeah.
Like-minded people, right? Yeah. I think that's the biggest thing is you tend to go in groups and you need to have that support community because it's too much information to try to process by yourself. I'm one of many people here at my firm, right?
Yeah.
I don't know everything for sure. I don't know. And every day I'm reminded of that fact, right? It's just, there's so much out there, but thank God that we work with really good people. And as a group, we'll be able to get the answer. You don't need to know everything yourself. You just need to have a trusted, it could be a smaller group. It could be like you guys, where you can trust the information that you're being provided and say, all right, yeah, that. And if they point you to somebody, then you can rely that they know that person that they're pointing to actually knows what they're doing.
Yeah, totally. I want to use the time that we have to talk about 5 tax tips for pilots. So pilots are now making great money, great contracts, mm-hmm. and they've got bigger tax problems. So what would you say are the 5 things? And I would love to, well, I'd love to sneak in HSAs somewhere in there. Maybe that's not in your top 5, but kind of how HSAs work, because that's a very popular thing now with healthcare plans. But
I was literally thinking about HSAs going, would I put that in the down? I was just kind of counting now. What would be my
I think it's so easy to do, right? So, I mean, maybe we start there.
If you have a spouse or time to be a real estate professional, then real estate professional. And that's 750 hours, more than half of your time spent in a profession during the year in a real estate trader business. So it doesn't have to be your real estate. It could just be, hey, I'm going to be an agent or I'm going to do construction on the side or my spouse is going to do that. As long as they do 750 hours and it's more than half of the time that their personal service time is what they call it. Then you meet prong one. Prong two is, did I materially participate on my real estate? And you aggregate your real estate as one activity. And then it's kind of the same test that I told you earlier about. It could be, I do everything or I do 100 hours, or I do 500 hours. There's a few other tests, but those are the big ones.
And that's episode 14, right, Tate? I think it was episode 14.
We touched on it on both 10 and 14. We've also done a deep dive with Billy Withers on that. I don't know the episode, but we can link mm-hmm. to it. And then we also have another episode that we just recorded with Brandon Hall doing a deep dive. So we've talked a lot about that strategy. If you want more resources, Ryan and I have some that we can send you. Just reach out.
Yeah. Brandon knows what he's talking about, by the way. That's real estate,
yep,
guys.
Yeah.
Don't want to point out, but I like people that actually know what they're talking about. He knows what
that's great.
Well, that's a big endorsement.
It is.
Yeah. Very few people do.
Nice.
Like, I'm sure he'd tell you when he run across someone that actually has some semblance of an idea.
Yeah.
Isn't shelling a bad concept. You say, yeah, they're solid. They know what they're doing. But real estate professionals, one, short-term rentals is a loophole that if you're willing to put a property into service and make it a short-term rental in the first year, then you can get the bonus depreciation. Even if you've had a property for a while, you can do that. Same strategy. You're going to have to keep it as a short term for a year. But if you haven't done a cost segregation and bonus depreciation, then you could pick the year. I could have bought the property 5 years ago and I could pick to do it. I'm going to do it.
What if you bought it before bonus depreciation came in? What if you put it into service as a long-term rental in 2015? You still own it?
Yeah. So if you put it into service in 2015, then you've been depreciating that pretty extensively.
Right.
All right. So when we do the bonus, we know without even, not bonus, if we do a cost right. seg, and a cost seg is a fancy way of saying is breaking an asset down into its 5-year, 7-year, 15-year, and 27 and a half year life, right? If it's residential property. So if it's a typical rental, if it's non-residential or hotel, it's 39 years. years, right? Most people and most accountants instinctively go to that 27 and a half year as their depreciation schedule, which it's a fancy way of saying I'm going to deduct the improvement that is put on the land. I don't deduct and depreciate land. I only deduct and depreciate the improvement. But we start with this 27 and a half years, and that's not the way you're supposed to do it. That's actually impermissible, but they let you do it because it costs you money. You're supposed to go into that house and say, here's its removable flooring, window covers, specialty electric to appliances, plumbing to appliances, all that stuff's supposed to be 5 year, 7 year, 15 year property. Land improvements, Ryan, you deal with this in your storage. I can't even imagine how much land improvement you're depreciating. But my guess is that you're writing off a good 50% of your projects. Is that
about 60%.
More than that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
About 60%. Yep. So the way to think about this is if you bought a $300,000 house, let's say 60,000 of its land, so you got 240,000, your write-off every year is probably about 8,000 or 9,000 if you just did it over 27 and a half years. That same property, you would get a, let's say about an $80,000 or $100,000 deduction in year one if you bonus depreciated after a cost say. So if I can make that ordinary loss and it could come through and lower my W-2 income, it's going to save me 20 or 30 grand, right? So that's where you start looking at the numbers. And if you're leveraging, you start going, hey, the tax savings are about my down payment. Yep.
Exactly.
So the government's basically buying the property for me. It pays for itself. And all I have to do is sit on it for the next 20 years and I'm going to get all the appreciation and I'm going to own that thing outright. And it's just going to sit there and kick me cash into my retirement. Yes, that's exactly how it works.
Which that right there, I just want to just foot stomp on that right now, because there's this age old debate, like stocks versus real estate. And it's like, in my mind, it's no contest just because, and God, I'm not kicking the stock market whatsoever. We all should have a balanced portfolio. But Toby, what you said right there is what people forget is that the amortization, right? Like even if it never cash flowed and it never appreciated, over 20 or 30 years, your tenants pay down your debt to zero. You own the asset outright. And because of the tax benefits, the government subsidized your down payment. So anyway, I don't want to step on you, but
I've done videos, by the way, on stocks versus real estate. I got to fight with you a little. So when you're illiquid and you don't have a lot of money, then I like stocks because you can make money several different ways on stock. And it's you could be in it if you had $5,000. It's a little bit tough to enter real estate, $5,000, right? You're not going to buy a house. You might be able to do some wholesaling, things like that, but that's work. So from an investment standpoint, a lot of people are really good. But you could still do real estate in the stock market by doing REITs, by doing private investments and things. Like if you just don't have the time, but you can't ever depreciate stock. The only way you make stock deductible is if you're doing it with an HSA or a 401k or an IRA, where you're going in there and you're saying, I want a tax deduction. And then I'm going to buy this asset, this cash flowing asset, and I'm going to let it basically grow for many years and do that. But I'm a guy that I'm going to throw a term at you. I call it being a stock market landlord. I treat everything like I'm a real estate investor, and I would not buy a house and leave it vacant. I would rent it.
Right.
Same thing with your plane. Same thing with your stocks. And then you're going to say, well, how do you rent a stock? Well, you sell covered calls on it, or you buy dividend producing stocks and sell covered calls on it. But you never just hope things get more value. You always got to have a kind of a focus on where they're producing cash flow. And just to bring this all the way around, that's why real estate kicks butt, because for years and years, it's gone up steadily. Like the last, 4 or 5 years, we've had this massive increase in rents and all that because they printed so much money. So you got to see what happens when they create inflation to real estate. You've seen it in everybody that was screaming that real estate was going to crash doesn't understand real estate, and they don't understand inflation. They did, they wouldn't be thinking it's going to crash. They'd have been saying, oh my gosh, real estate's going to get really pricey. Mm-hmm. I should own some of it now. And everybody that said that to themselves pre-COVID, during COVID, is doing really well right now. And everybody who said, no, it's going to crash, they're paying pretty high rent.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Well, thanks for, right. for expounding on that.
I think we're at number three, yeah. right? We got two down.
What did we do? We did real estate professional, yeah. short-term rental. I'm going to just poke in there charitable giving. So a lot of folks don't realize that you can give and you can actually create your own charity at some point. If you don't want to do it now, like you're like, oh, I need to keep all my money. Well, when you get in a high enough tax bracket, there's something to be said for getting a donation for an asset. Let's say that I gave a stock that I say I was Elon Musk fan years ago, and I ended up with a bunch of Tesla and it's gone up 500%. I could sell that and pay tax on all the gain and then donate some of that money, or I could just give the stock and get the entire value as a deduction. So I'll use an example that I did recently. I had a house and I purchased it. Ryan, you may have heard this story before, but I had a friend whose mom is blind and she lost her house to the bank. They foreclosed on her. And he came to me and said, hey, would you help me? I don't know what to do. And I said, you know, okay, how about this? I'll go buy it from the bank. If they're in the foreclosure, let's see where they're at. I couldn't get it pre-foreclosure. So I waited for the bank to foreclose on it, bought it back for 90 grand, let mom stay in it. I had some imputed rent and stuff. It was kind of annoying. So I said, this really isn't appropriate. I was going to sell it back to him, but he wasn't in a position to buy it. So I waited 2 years and then I donated it to one of my charities that I operate. And I was like, here, I'll just give mom. It's a stewardship, so it met its criteria. So I donated it and I said, mom can stay there for the rest of her life. She's blind, right? Like, why would I? But this way, at least I get a tax deduction. Well, here's the funny part. That $90,000 house was valued by the appraisal at $315,000. Remember, I bought it after the foreclosure. Son went over there, fixed it up a little bit. COVID comes along, prices go up. And the tax deduction to me was worth more than I paid for the house. Mm-hmm. And now I have a house and a charity that's right now I'm giving it to the mom, but she's 88 years old. There's going to come a point where that's either a cash flowing asset for the charity, which I could take a salary mm-hmm. out of, or I just use it for my charitable purpose and allow it to grow. But I really like that. Even for folks that are $200,000-$300,000 a year, it starts to make sense because you get a nice tax deduction. And I could be taking appreciated assets that I don't want to sell, but maybe I'm a giver anyway. I'm a big believer in giving a chunk of your income. But instead of you doing it, maybe you do it through either your own charity or a private foundation. You could set those things up. But I like that because I could, at a stroke of a pen, lower my taxes quite easily. I would say that's one. I know you're going to ask me number four. A good number four is to have a business that creates a loss, or to have a business that, even if I'll use you guys as an example, let's say that you work, or a typical pilot is working W-2, and I don't know, does the airline reimburse your cell phone?
Nope.
Reimburse your cell phone or anything like
nope.
that? They don't. So you have expenses that you're incurring along the way. What if I set up a small little side business and it could be doing just anything you could think of, even if maybe you're going to do lessons on the side, maybe you're going to do your plane on the side, maybe it's producing a little bit of income. It doesn't really matter, because what happens is things like this, if you set it up correctly, become deductible and it can reimburse you 100% of those costs. If I am set up correctly, that means I'm an S Corp, C Corp, or an LLC taxed as either. And then I can do an accountable plan. I could do an administrative office at my home. I can do 288. I could do a whole bunch of things that create the ability of the company to pay me for something I'm already incurring, and I don't have to pay tax on it. So it sounds kind of funky, but if you made $10,000 a year doing a side gig, it could be Turo. It could be doing anything on the internet. You could be doing social media, whatever. Fill in the blank. Run your own website where you have some subscription, where they're learning whatever a skill that you're really good at, or create a pilot's forum and have them charge a small fee, whatever it is. That $10,000 comes out to you tax-free. And just about everybody could use that, especially if you're W-2 and you're not getting reimbursed for a lot of the things, whether it be travel, whether it be the ability to go to conferences or things like that. All of those things become deductible to that business. And all it means is, hey, something I would have paid for anyway, but now it's tax-free. And so I'm offsetting some income.
And there's one additional benefit to that. We don't have time to dive into it right now, but I want listeners to sort of earmark this for later. If you have one of those side hustles, you can also start a solo 401k, right, Toby? Which is an incredible vehicle that we can get into on a different show.
That was actually number five.
Okay, perfect.
Was tax-deferred accounts. And I was going to say that there's different flavors. A lot of you guys are used to IRAs, and they always hear about a Roth IRA. And let me just put this out there. Depending on if your tax bracket is going to be higher during retirement or lower during retirement, but let's assume that it stays the same. The numbers for a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA are virtually identical. So don't stress over it. I'm probably taking the tax deduction now because if I'm a pilot, because chances are you're in a higher tax bracket than you're going to be when you retire. Most people, like 80 or 90%, it's like they go down during retirement. They always say, what are you going to do? What do you think they're going to do? They're going to raise taxes. That could be true, but statistically, people's tax returns, the amount that they pay on their overall income, is significantly lower during retirement than it is during your prime earning years. So I tend to want to take a deduction. So that leads us to things where I get a tax deduction. So that's 401ks, that's IRAs, that's SEPs, and Ryan's favorite, the HSA.
Thank you.
And that HSA is your health savings account. And it's a triple threat is what you call it. And the reason it's called a triple threat is because not only do you get a tax deduction for putting money into it, I think this year it's right around $7,800 as a family. If you have a high deductible health plan, you could put it in there and cover your, you could start reimbursing your expenses right away. Or get this, you could just let it grow, put it in a Fidelity account, a Schwab account or something, and let it grow. And whatever medical expenses you have from the point that you set it up on, you could reimburse at any time. So you could wait 10 years. So you just track your medical expenses, anything that you've had, copays, anything that you've had. Oh, shoot, I had all these expenses. You just can't pay your medical premium unless you're on Medicaid. I believe that's the one rule. But anything that's coming out of your pocket, eventually you're going to be able to reimburse. Even if you incur it now and don't reimburse it for 5 years, you could still do it. But you get a deduction now for putting that money in there. It grows tax-free. And so long as you use it for health expenses, you don't pay tax on it when it comes out. It literally is tax-free money. It's the only kind that we really know of. I get a deduction and it grows tax-free and I pay nothing out. People will say, well, that's what a Roth is. And it's like, no, that's not what a Roth is. You pay tax when you're going into right. The Roth. If you're a young person, like you're 18 years old and you're making less than the standard exclusion, so I make less than 14 grand a year, yeah, it's tax-free. And then now I'm kind of like an HSA, but that's not for any of us. All of us are in a higher tax bracket. That HSA becomes a nice tool. Especially if you're going to let it grow for 20 years.
It's amazing.
It'd be a big chunk.
And you could buy a rental property with it, yeah?
Yeah, you could go and self-direct it. You're not going to get it with the 7,000.
Right.
You're going to have to wait a few years. I put money in it. It was a company that was a smaller company. And I knew one of the folks that was a CFO in it. And I was like, oh, this looks like a decent thing. And it popped up and immediately go, oh, crap, I should probably sell it if it's popping up. And made a bunch of money in it. You have Peter Thiel, who did PayPal. He owned PayPal inside of his Roth, and it turned into, what, $4 billion. Like, you hear about those, but it's hard to get the startup capital.
Right.
There is a way to do it, Ryan. This is fun. And there's, like, stupid stuff that you can do in the tax world. You could set up a 401k, and you can overfund your account and not take a deduction. So I could put up to, what's the max?
69.
It's like 69. Yeah, so I could put $69,000 into my 401k, and then I could roll it into my Roth 401k.
Right.
Same plan, just a different account. I never took a deduction, and because it was an in-service distribution, no tax, no nothing. Now I have $69,000 in a Roth. I never got a deduction for the 69, but I'll never pay tax on any of that money or the growth ever.
And that's exactly what I did when I left the regional airlines that I flew for. Is I took that 401k and I rolled it into a Roth when I switched airlines. So it's like
So you actually paid tax on the
rollover.
That's true.
That's right? True. Well, I didn't pay tax on the rollover itself, but the money was already in a Roth bucket when it rolled over. So
And we perfect. So you did an in-service distribution.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild.
Well, that wasn't an in-service.
That's
that
how you
was
do it.
Ryan separated from his previous company. He had the old dusty 401k that he was able to roll into an IRA rather than bring it into his major airline 401k, which we talk about a lot. And we have an episode coming up where we're going to talk about conversions and all of the intricacies around taking a traditional account and rolling all or some of it into the Roth.
Do the math. Do the math on those. If you're in a higher tax bracket,
it would only make sense on those years where, let's say you're a real estate professional, you're buying a massive piece of property, you're smashing your tax bill, and you're like, hey, I've got room this year to convert some.
If you do that, you just nailed it right on the head. If you decide I'm going to do bracket management, I'm going to get, like you said earlier, Ryan, I think you said at the very beginning, like 0%, it could be reasonable. Yeah, but if I'm at zero and I have $200,000 in an IRA, I'm converting.
Yep. Yeah, because, good point. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm going to say, I know that this is the lowest tax. Now I'm never going to have to worry about it again. I'm going to use it up. I hate leaving 10%, 12%, 22% brackets on you.
That, hold on a second. That is like a number one tip. I mean, think about it. If you're a new FO and you're at the bottom of the list and you're starting at Delta, American, whatever, that's the least amount of money you're probably going to make ever again. Let's hope, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So if there's a time to convert your traditional IRA to a Roth, that is the year to do it. And it stings a little bit, right? Because you're starting. So you got to have the liquidity to pay the taxes and all this other stuff. But, and again, this isn't tax advice or legal advice. This is just friendly conversation, right? Between a couple of pilots and Toby. But, you know, that might be a great year to do it if you can swing it, because then you're going to be making way more than that. And you're going to pay the worst tax, the highest tax that you'll ever pay on that conversion.
Yeah. They're paying in probably about 10% on the first 100,000. It's not huge.
Yeah.
But remember, this is what's federal income tax. They're getting you on the old age disability and survivors stuff too.
Yeah.
So it's like a little kick in the shin. But I think you're 22% between about 94 and 200 or thereabouts. So like, that's not horrible. I'm probably converting at that. You don't have to convert the whole amount, but it's worth having the conversation saying, man, I'm going to be in a really low tax bracket. And if it's a year where you're taking a loss and it's going to knock you down even farther, hey, I'm going to be at $80,000. Great. Convert.
Yep.
It's probably be the only time you're going to get to.
I mean,
do
yeah,
it.
It's interesting how we started the show talking about, hey, pilots are making more money. How do we save on taxes? But there's also years that you need to think about when I'm making less money. There's tax strategies you can do to mitigate your taxes in the future. So it's not about making more or making less necessarily. There's always something to do no matter how much you're making.
Absolutely. So
yeah, just being smart about it and making sure that if I'm in a year where I am doing some loss harvesting, I'm able to, maybe I am getting into that plane and it is active participation. And it is, and by the way, I could do this in 1 year and then the next year go and be passive and everything else. Like I'm just, this is a 1 year strategy where this 1 year I'm looking and I want to make sure that I get a nice big fat loss. Fantastic. Be looking at that, doing your bracket management and making sure that you're converting things if appropriate, right? Don't let a 10% tax bracket go to waste or 12%. Make sure you're using
them. Fantastic. Well, Toby, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're over on time. We appreciate you being with us. These sessions are just fantastic. So thank you again.
Hey, my pleasure. And hopefully next time we got to do a deep dive into the leasing thing. You got to let me dig into that. And it'll be fun.
We'll bring it back.
All right, thank you again for joining us. We'll see you on the next episode, everyone.